Job has always been a relatively insignificant Old Testament book to me. And once I asked Jeff to do this, I started really pouring into it, and I've found out that it is probably as important as one of Paul's epistles in the Bible. It really is an important book. For all that it contains, especially about faith and relationships. And we as the readers of Job get a chance to see this all happen from the mezzanine, looking down on it happening. And that's a view that even Job didn't get to enjoy. And I don't know if he enjoyed any of it. But I've, ever since I started doing this, I have found out what I think Jeff has probably been going through for years. I've had every reason and every request from my family and people outside of me, outside of my family, to not be here on the Sundays of January and February. I mean, you can't imagine what is hit. Every single weekend has been, somebody has said, you know, I need you to go here or there or do something else. And I've had to say, no, we're not going to do this. We're going to stick to what I've planned to do. I've had every distraction at home when I should be studying and trying to prepare for this. All of a sudden, TV becomes very important and somebody comes up and talks to me. I mean, and it comes in spades. I'll be wasting time in front of the TV, and I'll finally say to myself, I'm going to get up from here and I'm going to go do the studying that I'm going to do. And somebody comes along and says, can I talk to you for an hour, hour and a half? I'm like, oh my gosh, it's never going to happen. I'm never going to get the studying done that I need done. It's amazing. So Satan overplays his hand every time. And it's obvious that he does some. And then last night, you're going to have to forgive me, I came down with the first cold in 3 years. So if Jeff has had to go through this for 40 years of constantly being attacked before coming up here, we all need to pray for him, because he really deserves some of that. And it makes me appreciate some of the things that you've gone through more. So thank you. So, Job is considered one of the oldest books of the Bible, and is written sometime between the year 2000 and 1700 BC. It's the story of a believer hundreds of years before the law was written down at Sinai. And I don't think we really understand how God drew men to himself when there was no written scripture, or how men passed on accurately inerrant spiritual principles. But it is obvious that these men were not completely ignorant of salvation by grace, of need of blood sacrifice, and of the coming Messiah. And Job lived in the land of Uz. And the land of Uz's exact whereabouts is unknown to us, except by clues associated with genealogical charts and people groups that can give us a close location, but not the exact one. The word Uz means wooded. This is one of the many clues that ancient Canaan was green and lush. When I read descriptions of ancient Israel in the Bible, I get hints of a beautiful green land of northern forests and green meadows, ample enough to feed all the animals needed for their culture. An agricultured land of milk and honey, not nearly the arid and rocky hillsides of much of what Israel is today. I know it's getting better there since the people have gone back and they've started to cultivate and plant things, but I think the wars of the Romans, the Seleucids, and just ravaged the land, and it was pretty much a wasteland for a long time. Job is called the greatest man of the East. In Israel, everything is East. because the Mediterranean is to the west. So that's not much help in identifying where the land of Uz is located. But in Genesis, it's recorded that Uz was the son of Aram, the son of Shem, the son of Noah. In other words, Uz was Noah's great-grandson. And Aram's family tribe became the Arameans. And they are the ancestors of modern-day Syrians. When the Bible speaks of Aram, this land was located in southern Syria and western Iran. So somewhere in this area, northeast of Israel today, is the location of the land of Uz. By the way, there is a fair amount of prophecy in the scriptures concerning Aram that has not yet been fulfilled. The years Job lived has no firm date, but several clues will put him living around the time of Esau and Jacob. His death at the age of 140 is chronologically fixed around the time when between Abraham and Jacob. And this is the time several hundred years after the flood, when the life expectancies were gradually shortening from a flood, pre-flood of 800 or 900 years old to what they are today. If you take all the people, all the patriarchs of the Old Testament, and you put them on a timeline from when they were born and when they died, it makes a timeline similar to this. I mean, and if you can see Adam through Noah and even Shem, their lives were hundreds of years old. But as soon as the flood happened, something happened. What? I don't know. I don't think anybody knows. But their lifespans began to getting shorter. Well, you take the other chart, put it up, and you put them end to end so that you're comparing their lifespans. You see that once you come to Noah, all of a sudden there is a shortening of lifespans and it starts going down. And when you get over to Abraham at the end, he lived 175. Isaac lived into about 160. And Jacob lived about 145. And it says that Job lived to be 140 years old. So that puts, by this chart, that would put Job in and around the time of Isaac and Jacob. Okay, you can turn that off. Job's friend Eliphaz, the Temanite. And for us who are really into like biblical genealogies, ite means the people of. So, thus it means the people of Teman. Eliphaz, Teman's son, was the grandson of Esau. And by this estimate, Job lived around the time of Jacob moving to Egypt. Here's a little history sidebar that had its beginning in the years of Job's life, that is relevant to the book of Esther and the celebration of our Christmas story that was completed just before and during these last holidays. Eliphaz's half-brother was Amalek. Amalekites were the first people group to oppose Israel's migration back into the Canaan after leaving Egypt. King Saul was directed by God to wipe out all the Amalekites, and he failed to do so, and some of the Amalekites survived. This led to his eventual replacement as king by King David. In the book of Esther, Haman, who was descended from the Amalekites, attempted the first Holocaust that was thwarted by Esther and Mordecai. And the Idumean King Herod the Great, also descended from the Amalekites, killed all the baby boys 2 years and under in an attempt to wipe out Jesus in his youth. And in our generation, Yasser Arafat, the butcher of Entebbe, followed in his ancestors' footprints. The book of Job begs the question, why do bad things happen to good people? It squashes the faith and prosperity doctrines, especially those that insinuate that faith brings health, wealth, and happiness, and that nothing happens to righteous people with faith. And God uses Job's trouble for a good purpose in the end. Romans 8 says, "And we know that God causes all things to work together for those who love God and those who are called according to His purpose." And like I said before, we have the privilege of seeing this story happen from God's point of view and seeing the spiritual warfare that Job misses out on during his trial. So let's begin reading. "There was a man in the land of Uz whose name was Job, and that man was blameless, upright, fearing God, and turning away from evil. 7 sons and 3 daughters were born to him. His possessions were also 7,000 sheep, 3,000 camels, 500 yoke of oxen, 500 female donkeys, and very many servants. And that man was the greatest of all men in the east. His sons used to go and hold a feast in the house of each one on his day, and they would send and invite their 3 sisters to eat and drink with them. When the days of feasting had completed their cycle, Job would send and consecrate them, rising up early in the morning and offering burnt offerings according to the number of them all. For Job said, 'Perhaps my sons have sinned and cursed God in their hearts.' Thus Job did continually." So Job was a blameless man of reputation. He had strong integrity without moral blemishes. How many of us can claim that we're blameless without Jesus Christ? I know I can't. He was upright, which denotes a levelness in his life and his thinking processes, and strength against adversity. A building that is not erected level and square multiplies mistakes in its structure. In a way, if we're not upright, we do the same thing in our character. In a building that's unlevel, the doors and windows don't close properly. Even the shallow end of the bathtub become the deep end. So the house is a half a bubble off a plum. People are drawn to an upright home because they want to live there. Upright would have been a good quality for the candidates in this past election. Job feared God. Proverbs 9 says that the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. Knowledge of the Holy One is understanding. So he was a wise man because he had a relationship with God. And he turned away from evil. 1 Corinthians 6 says, "Flee your immorality. Every other sin that man commits is outside the body, but an immoral man sins against his own body." Job had 7 sons and 3 daughters. I like this guy. My family of 5 sons and 2 daughters revolves around the kids. There's a lot of things going on all the time. And I bet it was fun at his house, you know, parties, games, friends coming over, fires, barbecues, paintball. It had to have been a good time. His possessions include 7,000 sheep, 3,000 camels, 500 yoke of oxen, 500 female donkeys. In today's equivalent, in our society, that would be like having a large farm with livestock and sheep, a heavy equipment company, a trucking company, a taxi cab company, and a new car dealership, all rolled into one. So if he didn't have, you know, if Job did not have skid steers and backhoes on his farm, he had to have hundreds of servants just to maintain and clean up the place. I mean, he had 8,300 animals, man. That's a lot of poop. So the children would feast and drink wine and celebrate on their day. And I know, you know, a good wine and cheese party can get a little loose. And Job was concerned about the condition of his children's souls. I know I am all the time. I continually pray for my kids. And we fathers are the priests of our families. Job knew God requires a blood sacrifice for sins, because the wages of sin is death. He made sure that his children were under the blood. And this was before Christ, and sacrificed animals was a necessary sacrifice to keep one's salvation in relationship with God. And it sounds like a lot of work to do, always going and having a sacrifice and all the work involved in that. And that was before Christ died and was resurrected. And so now all we have to do is pray, right? That's the extent of our commitment. I don't think so. Let's be sure that we're not taking Yeshua for granted. There's still a lot of work involved in working out our salvation. Remember, faith without works is dead. We've been bought with a price. What price? The death of God on a cross. Let's not take him for granted. Continue on in Job. Now there was a day when the sons of God came to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan also came among them. The Lord said to Satan, "From where do you come?" Then Satan answered, the Lord and said, "From roaming about on the earth and walking around on it." And the Lord said to Satan, "Have you considered my servant Job? For there is no one like him on the earth, a blameless and upright man, fearing God and turning away from evil." Then Satan answered the Lord, "Does Job fear God for nothing?" Have you not made a hedge about him in his house and all that he has on every side? You have blessed the work of his hands, and his possessions have increased in the land. But put forth your hand now and touch all that he has, and he will surely curse you to your face. Then the Lord said to Satan, "Behold, all that he has is in your power. Only do not put forth your hand on him." So Satan departed from him and from the presence of the Lord. The Bible says the sons of God came and presented themselves before the Lord, and Satan came with them. Sons of God here does not refer to human men. Man does not have access to God face to face because he is a fallen into sin. And this was not a committee meeting. God does not need the counsel from men or angels. This was an angelic praise meeting gathering, and it was interrupted by Satan. We should know a little bit about our enemy, Satan. He's not God's opposite, but he's a created fallen angel. John 8 says, "No truth is found in him. He's the father of lies." In John 10, he says, "He is a thief that has come to steal, kill, and destroy." He's come to steal our possessions, our health, our family, and our souls. He's come to kill our joy, our peace, our families, and our lives, destroy our relationship with God, our mates, our children, and our Christian brothers and sisters. He hates us because we are made in God's image and despises God's love for us, a fallen, sinful race. Job was not Satan's first and last target in the scriptures. In Genesis, Eve and Adam were attacked by Satan possessing the body of a serpent. In Luke 13, Jesus says, "This woman is a daughter of Abraham, and she is whom Satan has bound for 18 long years. Should she not have been released from the bond on the Sabbath day?" In Luke 22, Jesus says, "Simon, Simon, behold, Satan has demanded permission to sift you like wheat, but I have prayed for you." In 1 Peter 5, it says, "Be of a sober spirit, be on the alert. Your adversary, the devil, prowls around like a roaring lion, seeking for someone to devour." That's us, each of us. In one way, I get an impression that Satan has showed up to this praise gathering of angels with no particular agenda and was challenged by God to consider Job. So is God setting up Satan here? Or is it God's plan to break Job and discipline him and make Job more like Christ? Satan is a malevolent spirit, and God is protecting all of us from him in ways that we don't even comprehend. We all have fences around us to keep him out. 1 Corinthians 10 says, "No temptation has overtaken you, but such is common to man, and God is faithful, who will not allow you to be tempted beyond what you are able, but with temptation will provide a way of escape also, so that you'll be able to endure it." Now, on the day when the sons and Job's sons and daughters were eating and drinking wine in their oldest brother's house, a messenger came to Job and said, "The oxen were plowing and the donkeys feeding beside them, and the Sabians attacked and took them. They also slew the servants by the edge of the sword, and I alone have escaped to tell you." While he was still speaking, another also came and said, "The fire of God fell from heaven and burned up the sheep and servants and consumed them, and I alone have escaped to tell you." While he is still speaking, another also came and said, "The Chaldeans formed three bands and made a raid on the camels and took them, and slew the servants with the edge of the sword, and I alone have escaped to tell you." While he was speaking, another also came and said, "Your sons and your daughters were eating and drinking wine in their oldest brother's house, and behold, a great wind came across the wilderness and struck the four corners of the house, and it fell on the young people, and they died, and I alone have escaped to tell you." Then Job arose and tore his robe, and shaved his head, and he fell on the ground and worshipped. And he said, "Naked I have come into my mother's womb, and naked I shall return there. And the Lord gave, and the Lord has taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord." Through all this, Job did not sin, nor did he blame God. I can't imagine. What I see here is that Satan set a tornado and it took down the house of his brother, oldest son. You know, and then people coming and attacking and taking his land and killing all the servants. And it was a tough one. And then there was a day the sons of God came and presented themselves before the Lord, and Satan also came along to them to present themselves before the Lord. And the Lord said to Satan, "Where have you come from?" Then Satan answered the Lord and said, "From roaming around on the earth and walking around on it." And the Lord said to Satan, "Have you considered my servant Job? For there is no one like him on the earth, a blameless and upright man, fearing God and turning away from evil. And he still holds fast his integrity, although you incited me against him to ruin him without cause." So who takes responsibility for what goes on? Is Satan? Does God? It's a good point. It's something that's wrestled on, about for by many people. When it comes to bad things happening to good people, who takes responsibility? Satan answered the Lord and said, "Skin for skin. Yes, all that a man has, he will give for his life. However, put forth your hand now and touch his bone and his flesh, and he will curse you to your face." So the Lord said to Satan, "Behold, he is in your power, only spare his life." And Satan went out from the presence of the Lord and smote Job with sore boils from the sole of his foot to the crown of his head. And he took a broken piece of pottery to scrape himself while he was sitting among the ashes. One of the things that I spent a little bit of time trying to figure out is, what disease did Satan give Job? And I've heard everything, read everything from diabetic complications to smallpox to any number of different kinds of diseases. And personally, nobody knows. really what it was. It was boils from the top of his head to his feet. They're, boils are big pimples full of pus, and they're really nasty. And I think it, whatever disease it was probably a combination of several diseases. You know, why would Satan give him one disease when he could give him three? I don't know. We really don't know what it was that he had, but he had what it was terrible, and it was over all of his body. And the only thing he could, only place he could find that was of any comfort to him was sitting amongst a real, bunch of really soft ashes in a fire pit. So the picture of Job is he's sitting in this ash pit. He's got these oozing sores on his body, and he's scraping them off with a piece of broken glass. And he is just a dirty mess from one end to the other. Job lost everything that was important to him and that defined him as a man in this world. How many of us define our lives by our possessions? For instance, our homes, especially of us who have built our own house or have worked to pay mortgages and other bills and providing for our families all our life. How many of us define our lives by our cars that give us freedom to come and go as we please? I know that when my children finally got their driver's licenses, man, it was like, I'm free, and away they go. You know, and they were no longer housebound. How many of us describe our lives today by our businesses, our jobs, our careers? Those things that provide us with necessities, food and shelter, clothing, and the ability to live comfortably. And how about our health, without which none of this life is possible without receiving some form of charity? I know that one personally. I no longer work. How many of us define our lives by our relationships? And in this life, nothing else is more important than our relationships. This is why we were created, to love, to be loved by God and our families and other people. We weren't created to accumulate toys, money, and influence, none of which will pass on into eternity with us. Just our relationships. Then Job's wife said to him, "Do you still hold fast your integrity? Curse God and die." But Job said to her, "You speak as one of the foolish women speaks. Shall we indeed accept good from God and not accept adversity?" In all this, Job did not sin with his lips. We've got to know that Mrs. Job is a victim here of Satan's animosity as well as her husband was. She lost all her 10 children, all her possessions, her community status, and all her servants, except for 4. And if I was one of them, I would have delivered my message, left home, and would have never gone back. Mrs. Job is left with a dying husband to care for. She is angry, hurting, and despairing. Satan now tweaks Mrs. Job's feelings, and she goes over the edge, insulting her husband's integrity, her husband's honor, his ethics, and his strong moral convictions and belief that God is steadfastly important in his life. Her wording implies that he is a fool and he needs to go to hell. Matthew 5 says, "But I say to you, everyone who is angry with his brother shall be guilty before a court. And whoever says to his brother, 'You good for nothing,'" or it says "raca" in some translations, "shall be guilty before the Supreme Court. And whoever says, 'You fool,' shall be guilty enough to go into a fiery hell." So let's give this a more modern translation of what Jesus was actually saying there in Matthew. If you're walking around with a chip on your shoulder, gossiping or backstabbing someone, then you're guilty enough to have a couple brothers and sisters pull you aside and comfort you, and confront you. If you're angry enough to publicly call somebody an ass to their face, then you're guilty enough to be sued in court. If you're angry enough to tell somebody to go to hell, then you really don't care about their eternal destiny. And your destiny, due to lack of belief and love, is at stake as well. I think the wives of our culture would have told him off, left home, and sued for divorce at that point. But let's give Mrs. Job some credit here. She stayed with him even though all was lost to her. Mrs. Job is the only thing that in Job's life that wasn't violently taken from him. But Job lost the love and sympathy of his companion and helpmeet. But she also is a survivor of the catastrophe, except that she disdained Job for it and wished him dead. I think from Job's point of view, that was probably worse because Satan used her to rip out another piece of Job's heart. But afterwards, Job spoke to her not in insults, but tenderly and firm, because he loved her, not returning insults for her curses. Therefore, Job did not sin with his lips, not to God, nor to his wife. The scripture goes on. Now, when Job's three friends heard of all this adversity and had come upon him, they came each one to his own place, Eliphaz the Temanite, Bildad the Shuhite, and Zophar the Naamite. And they made an appointment together to come and sympathize with him and comfort him. When they lifted up their eyes at a distance and they did not recognize him, they raised their voice and wept. And each of them tore his robe and they threw dust over their heads towards the sky. When they sat down on the ground with him for 7 days and seven nights, and no one speaking a word to him, for they saw that his pain was very great. Bildad was the son of Shua, the son of Abraham, through his third wife, Keturah. Zophar was from Naamah, and his relations are unknown. But they made an appointment, and due to the fact that Instagram did not exist back then, leads me to believe that it took several months for them to finally visit Job in his condition. So this was not something that happened the day before yesterday, and then they showed up and they spent time with Job. He'd already been suffering for quite a while. These men were men from the East, and they're not men from our American culture. You know, we don't rip up our clothes and dump dirt on our heads to show sympathy and sorrow. But personally, I like splitting wood and digging to work through my grief and losses. Just hanging out for a week without talking would be tough for me to go through. I'd rather help clean up Job's messy estate and rebuild Job's ravished homes and barns. And these three friends of Job, despite the fact that they are about to misrepresent God in the next 34 chapters, are doing it right. People really want relationships. And when they are down, they can be visited at home, at a nursing home. Sometimes we are the Jesus that our neighbors are going to see, the only Jesus. There are Jobs in this church here as I look around. Job was an extreme case, yes, but there are people in this church that need our time, for us to spend time with them. I'm not trying to embarrass anyone here, but we have people in this church who have lost children or who have children in need of 24-hour care, have lost appendages, have lost jobs, are homebound all the time, are institutionalized, have cancer, or just cannot make life work because Satan has oppressed them one way or another. Can we be Jesus to them? Doing that is not without its rewards. I know sometimes it's hard because we're so busy. But Jesus says, where two or more are gathered, He is with us there. And besides, we just might find close friends that we've always longed for by going and visiting and spending time with them. That is it.